Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
I think empathy has its place. I think empathy is a great source of pleasure. But I think empathy is a poor moral guide.
Hey there, podcast listeners. It's Anne here, and today we've got a special treat. Steve is joining us, and Steve, what are we doing?
Well, you may remember a few weeks ago we aired an interview with a psychologist, Paul Bloom, who wrote a book called Against Empathy. Turns out that that interview generated a lot of response from our listeners. Paul, this is a really counterintuitive argument you are making. It's hard to believe that anyone other than a psychopath would consider empathy to be a bad thing. Are you really advising people not to feel empathy?
Empathy suffers from various design flaws. So for one thing, it's very biased. We naturally feel empathy for people who are from our group, people who look like us, people who are cute. And it's very hard to feel empathy for people who are from another group, who are our enemies, who are strangers. And because of that, decisions guided by empathy tend to be highly biased, often racist. A second problem is empathy is like a spotlight. It zooms you in on one person. It often leads to just the wrong moral choices. One way I put it is it's because of empathy, we often care more about a little girl stuck in a well than we do about crises that could affect thousands or millions of people.
So that was part of a full hour we did a while ago asking if we really need other people in our lives at all. Hell is other people, as Jean-Paul Sartre said.
Not our most warm and friendly topic, I suppose.
Well, but so then something happened. You said we got a lot of mail, listener comments, after we aired that interview.
It turns out we missed something.
Hell isn't other people?
Well, you could debate that. But many of our listeners pointed out that empathy actually has a bunch of different definitions, depending on what line of work you're in. And a lot of people insisted that Paul Bloom was getting it wrong. He was not describing empathy, but instead maybe sympathy or emotional intelligence, at least if you go by the psychology literature.
Steve, we're married, and you know how little tolerance I have for debates about definitions.
Well, just wait. You know, reading all of this, a few comments caught the eye of our digital producer, Mark Rickers, like this one. Emotional connection and moral reasoning are really just the tip of the empathy iceberg. The takeaway? No empathy, no high tech, no advanced society. It's really that simple.
Wait, what?
So the connection between empathy and engineering seems counterintuitive, right?
Yes, totally.
So, well, we decided to get that listener in the studio. His name is Chuck Pozeski, and he's an engineering professor at Washington University.
So one of the things that we're really used to doing in this society is we're used to thinking in terms of different disciplinary specialties. So like an engineer must think different than, let's say, a psychologist. And we're really, really deeply embedded in that paradigm. In fact, when you stand up and say, actually, that's not the way it works, then people have a lot of pushback because they've been, you know, they've been kind of had this belief inculcated in them that an engineering professor thinks this way and a psychologist thinks this way and a doctor thinks this way.
Okay, well, let me move past the definitions then and talk about how you think empathy applies to your profession. I mean, you're an engineer, and I guess, you know, when I think of engineers, you know, I think of things like, you know, to the people who solve big problems, you know, who figure out how to, you know, go to Mars or something like that. Why do engineers need empathy to do their work?
Well, let me give you an example, okay?
Okay.
So, you know, let's say you're an engineer and you are designing a new revision for a rocket engine. Let me tell you, rocket engines are really complicated things. I mean, rocket science isn't called rocket science for nothing, okay? So, you know, it may be that there is a new material out that will give you, let's say, a 3% performance improvement for your rocket engine. That kind of thinking is actually relatively non-empathetic. What you want is you want an engineer who is an expert in specialty materials who understand how they're formed and so on and so forth. And they are going to be the authority, and the odds are that they are going to sit at the top of a hierarchy of other specialists. And at some level, there's not a lot of empathy in that particular aspect of design. Now, I call that, in my writing, I call that algorithmic design. That's a relatively low empathetic method of design, okay, because the experts are the ones. But now let's say you're trying to design an iPhone, okay, or you're trying to have a new, you're trying to have a breakthrough in paradigm about how to develop a kitchen mixer that everybody will feel very comfortable or use, or look at something like a Keurig coffee maker, okay? You're trying to reinvent the paradigm of how people drink coffee in the office, okay? Well, now it's really, really important to connect with a customer and understand their coffee habits, like how much coffee do they drink in a single serving? How strong do they like their coffee? Can we find this out, you know, by talking to them? Can we watch their behavior and see how that works? Well, in that case, empathy is really important because everything has to, not only does it have to work from a technical standpoint, but it has to not look ugly on the counter.
Aren't you basically just saying know your customer? I mean, you just have to know what your customer wants and how they're going to use the product and all of that?
You have to. I would say no, once again, is saying no, your customer is a one-way. It's a one-way ticket. What you actually have to do is you have to synergize with your customer. So your customer is going to tell you, and you're going to learn things from your customer. And at the same time, you're going to help the customer understand what your limitations are. So it's actually a shared creation. And in that case, you know, rational empathy really helps. And that's how most consumer products and lots of breakthrough products are actually designed, is in that kind of ferment. And, you know, there's a field out now called sense making, which I also write about, you know, where people not only now go out and collect, you know, user surveys and stuff, but they actually look and put together complex narratives that show how people might actually use something in the context of the day.
One thing I'm curious about is, I mean, my image of an engineer is that you quantify stuff as you're trying to solve your problems. You know, you have equations and, you know, it's you can sort of boil things down to a very quantitative basis. And I guess I'm wondering if you can quantify empathy in the same way that you might quantify, I don't know, power or energy or heat or light.
I think that the desire to quantify things is important. And it's what I call, whenever we come up with a design solution, we want to have it scaffolded out. So it's certainly important for, let's say, let's get back to the coffee maker, that, you know, the coffee is heated to, you know, the water is heated when it churns through the coffee to a certain temperature, 189 degrees, so that the coffee beans don't release bitterness and it's not so hot that it burns your tongue or something like that. But I think that there's also a whole field of synthesis that engineers do all the time in order to make sure that things fit. And you know, what I tell my students is that 80% of your job is social. It's not writing down equations. And that's just an old stereotype that people have about what engineering is all about. When you're trying to make, for example, a global supply chain, you have to talk to people around the world. And you have to know whether they're telling you to the best of their knowledge, so to speak, the truth of what their situation is. And when that doesn't happen, then you have all sorts of problems.
Are you kind of unusual among engineers to stress the importance of empathy? I'm guessing a lot of engineers wouldn't really think that much about this kind of stuff.
I'm a freak of nature, Steve. you're talking to a true space alien. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's nobody necessarily thinks about it in these terms. But people are starting to catch up, and where people are starting to press the boundaries of this stuff is in the, you know, in field that we call collective intelligence. My background is actually in complex system theory. It turns out that these concepts of self-similarity and emergence and all sorts of stuff that goes with nonlinear systems, which are kind of out of the scope of the interview, turn out to be really, really important in human dynamics because it makes that wonderful complex behavior that enables us to have the society that we have.
So basically, this guy, Chuck Pazeski, is saying that empathy is valuable because it gets engineers and users of technology to trust each other and listen to each other's ideas, and so they can make bigger and more useful and more intuitive things that solve problems more specifically. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, basically, yes. And Chuck gets into this stuff much more deeply on his blog, which is called empathy.guru, for those who are interested.
Okay, so I know we heard actually from a lot of different people about that empathy show. For some reason, it really sparked a lot of debate. Mm-hmm. So anybody else?
Yeah, we also heard from Indy Young, who's a designer who advises all sorts of companies on how they can integrate empathy into their design process. And she says that this is something that companies really need to understand. So we asked her how that works.
Empathy has a lot of different definitions, and the kind of empathy I work with is cognitive empathy. That's consciously cultivating an understanding of other people's perspectives. And the real key reason why I bring it in is that when people are trying to design software, or trying to design any sort of product or service, they're often doing it together just with their own experiences. And what I'm trying to do is bring a whole lot of other people's experiences into that room when they're doing those designs. There's a really famous example where there was an app for tracking health signs, like, you know, your heart rate and mm-hmm. all sorts of different things. And missing from it was tracking a woman's period. No one mentioned it because no one in the room
because
had
it probably the designers were all men.
Exactly. So, you know, that's a really simple example that everybody can wrap their head around. Oftentimes, though, I'm dealing with much more complex kinds of things like, you know, how do we support workplace safety? Or how do we support someone who is in charge of data storage? When I'm working with startups, this is extremely important because a startup has a short runway. They only have so much time and resources and money to actually accomplish something and get it out into the market. And so they can't solve everybody's problem. Oftentimes, they fail because they do try solving everybody's problem. And what I try to do is help them get to a more successful point by mm-hmm. focusing down. Okay, let's just work with this particular kind of approach, this kind of person, the way they think, or maybe these two kinds of people, the way they think.
So to come back to what you do, which is to create designs, better designs, using these principles of empathy, of sort of trying to get in the head of someone else, you're saying this is a sort of a different dimension of working with these businesses?
Yeah, it is. This is a new dimension. So I mentioned the word user research and solution space. I think we've gotten very good at checking out our ideas and making sure that they work. We'll check out ideas, we'll check out prototypes, we'll check out the actual services and products that we create for people. And we've gotten pretty good at that. Ideas are sexy, and when you make an idea and people like it, you get a lot of credit. And so we all sort of gravitate towards solving problems as opposed to spending that much time understanding the problem. So this is new, trying to understand the problem. There have been quite a bit of discussion about it lately. Om Malik did a piece in the New York Times about Facebook when we were just experiencing all those faux news pieces mm-hmm, that were right. getting bubbled around everybody. And he was, I think the title of his piece was, you know, we really need to pause. We need to pause first and understand all the implications of what's going on with our designs. By pausing up front, we can understand those implications before we cause the disasters.
I mean, what I find so interesting about what you're saying is, I mean, you're talking about unintended consequences. I mean, you might have a great idea, but you don't mm-hmm. exactly know what's going to come of it. But you're also saying, I mean, the problem is sort of a deficit of empathy. I mean, that's sort of the piece that seems new.
Actually,
to
what I would say is that it's a deficit of breadth. I think that people have empathy. I think they can have both emotional empathy and cognitive empathy when they're designing these things, but they don't have the breadth. They don't realize there are other perspectives out there. And since we live now in a digital world, we can take advantage of that long tail, right? We don't have to only support the kind of thinking that we understand. We can support other kinds of thinking, and it's really behooves us to go out and understand what that other kind of thinking is, what all of those other perspectives are, and map out, say, over the next 5-10 years, you know, who are we going to support next? How can we find out more about these other kinds of thinking? So it's recognizing that we've so far created digital products and services for a very small percentage of the world. And of course, I'm focusing on technology, but this, what I do, isn't constrained to technology. So I've actually worked with a fast food company designing menus and stuff like that. It's not constrained only to digital, but we can still have frustrating experiences. What's happening in a frustrating experience is that we're feeling as a person, as a human, as an individual, that someone else didn't think of us. Like, they didn't recognize our situation or this particular situation that maybe me and a group of others are in or something. And we get frustrated, not only that it doesn't do what we intended, but that there was some designer out there that we feel like we should blame, right?
Right.
This is all emotional. That has nothing to do really with empathy. We might be having an emotional reaction, thinking that designer didn't have empathy with us. But like I said earlier, it's really not about a deficit of empathy. It's a deficit of breadth. What we need to focus on is the idea that there are lots of different things to solve for. We've been so far solving for the low-hanging fruit, the easy stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I'm wondering about is, as you get better at this, I mean, you really sort of try to, you understand how people think, how people are using these products. I guess I'm wondering if there's also the danger of manipulation here. I mean, can you design user experiences essentially to trick people into doing things that they might otherwise not have any interest in doing?
So one of the things that I do with cognitive empathy is something that Daniel Goleman actually says, hey, that can lead to manipulation. And most often, I think that people default to thinking, hey, if I know how you think, then I can change how you think and I can make you do something you weren't intending to do. In most cases, that's bad. That's called a dark pattern. What I do is I emphasize, instead of manipulation, I emphasize support. What I really want people to do is be able to support other perspectives. I want people to think beyond the perspectives in the room that they're familiar with. I want whole companies to recognize that there are markets out there in the other, you know, 95% of the population of the world. And we need to start looking at those. Now's the time. We have the opportunity to get in now and start solving some of the more complex problems.
Yeah. Now, coming back to this whole idea of empathy, now, did you hear our interview with Paul Bloom?
Yeah. About,
okay.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. What was your impression of that? Do you feel like he was missing something?
You know, it's interesting. I don't disagree with his emphasis on compassion. His compassion is my support. I think what he's focusing on more is social stuff, and I'm focusing in a completely different direction. I think what he's focused on is something that is a very narrow definition of empathy.
Mm-hmm. What he's talking about is the dangers of applying these notions of empathy to developing your moral stands.
Yeah.
In the world.
Well, empathy is really, the way he's talking about it, an emotion. He's talking about emotional contagion, like bathing in their feelings. Mm-hmm. And he says that's very exhausting. And that's true, that bathing in someone else's feelings is very exhausting. It's what you do with the emotion afterward that counts. So I think that if we're strictly speaking about emotional empathy, which is really not my expertise, I think it's what you do with that emotion. So he could have said, the title of his book could have been like Against Anger or Against Contempt. It's the emotional maturity that you have to recognize what that emotion is and then make decisions based on it. We don't have a lot of maturity in our emotional recognition, our self-recognition, recognition in others. We just don't teach our kids that. And the focus really should be on the lack of emotional education the lack of, you know, teaching people to recognize and listen to other people in school. You know, we've got the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? We don't have listening.
Right.
We don't have speaking. We don't have handling our own emotions. And those are very important.
So, and you make this sort of very clear dividing line between emotional empathy and cognitive empathy.
Yes. Yeah. So I think one of the things that Paul says is that emotional empathy zooms you into one person. And you can like ignore the thousand other people because you're focused on that one person. Cognitive empathy also zooms you in on one person, but what I'm doing is I'm really intent on trying to bring those thousands of people into the room with the designers. So I am going out, I'm hunting around for all the different kinds of thinking styles that are out there, bringing those together in a specific format called a mental model diagram, and helping those people in the room, those designers in the room, recognize more perspectives. So I'm sort of doing the opposite. I'm bringing the thousands into the room.
Wow, kind of fascinating that we can learn so much even when it seems like maybe we were a little bit wrong.
And thanks to Indy and Chuck for taking the time to talk with us. And I have to say, it pays to have smart listeners.
That's it for this podcast extra, made possible by you, our wonderful listeners. But we will be back with a full hour soon. By the way, if you like this episode, leave a comment. We do read them, as you see. Or leave a rating on iTunes. That helps other listeners find us. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio, as well as from these folks.
PRI, Public Radio International.